The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Whitney Peeling, and I'm here to remind you to silence your cell phones, please, and refrain from taking any pictures during the event. And I'm also here to introduce tonight's speaker because I might be his biggest fan. Sometime in the year 2000, when I was a wee publicist in New York at what was then known as Houghton Mifflin Company, I asked my boss if she would pick me to work on a book that was coming out the next year about the fast food industry. It had been written by a contributing editor at the Atlantic Monthly, who I knew had won a National Magazine Award for an article he wrote about immigrant labor and strawberry picking in California. And to my great happiness, she said yes, which was probably the greatest day of my life. Because it meant that I would have the honor of working on Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation campaign. And I don't need to tell you the impact that that book has had on our country and the world, but I'll remind you that it's still an international bestseller that rivals Silent Spring or The Jungle for its influence on our environment, landscape, politics, economy, and culture. And that campaign is the reason that I'm still a book publicist today. And it also introduced me to the Free Library in Philly because the event that I booked with Eric here was the first that I had booked at the Free Library as a publicist. So I will close by saying that working with Eric was a treat in itself. Despite the urgency and intensity of the subjects that he writes about, he is one of the calmest, coolest, most fun authors that I've ever worked with. In the middle of a hectic tour, he would call me from like day 12 of a two-week stint. And this is usually the point when authors are understandably really grouchy and tired and just want to go home. And he would always begin the phone call by saying, "How are you doing? How's everything there? Is everything okay? How's your day?" So this does not happen on a regular basis. And he, unlike most authors who will name drop and claim great media connections, he was always modest to a fault and all the more beloved by his vast network for that reason. He's generous and he has a fantastic sense of humor. And more than anything, he's obscenely hardworking and a model of intellectual integrity. So I'm here now as a Philly-based friend and Schlosser fanatic, eager to hear him talk to us about his new book, which the New York Times is already calling disquieting and riveting, called Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety, from Penguin Press. So again, please silence your rectangular glowing devices that you carry in your pockets, and you can whisper your favorite nuclear joke to your friend next to you, and join me in welcoming Eric Schlosser.
That was so nice. And I just have to say for the record that Whitney is not my publicist now, and I had no idea what she was going to say. And so that was very, very nice. Thank you. Back at you, Whitney. Thank you for coming here tonight. This book is about a very dark subject, and some people wonder, you know, well, what's the connection between the work that you did on Fast Food Nation and now nuclear weapons? And I guess the answer is, these are both things that are bad for you. And nuclear weapons even more so than Chicken McNuggets or Big Macs. That's sort of the flippant response, but a more serious answer would be, both of these books are about powerful institutions in American society that have been very effective at controlling information and keeping the truth away from the American people. And in writing Fast Food Nation, I was very concerned about the impact of this one industry on our culture, on our diet, on our health. When it comes to nuclear weapons, I think it's one of the greatest threats that this nation faces and one of the most important subjects there is. I mean, for me, the two great existential threats that we face in the United States right now are global warming, which I do think is man-made, and nuclear weapons, which absolutely are man-made. This is an unusual book about nuclear weapons. Most of the books, and some beautiful books, have been written. Incredible books have been written about nuclear weapons. Most of them have focused on the high-level physicists of the Manhattan Project, like Oppenheimer or Teller. Or the books have been written by retired national security advisors. Henry Kissinger has written some important books on nuclear weapons. Or they've been the memoirs of diplomats. Again and again, you see these books that are really looking at the top of this system. I tried a different approach. This is a book that looks at the day-in, day-out management of our nuclear arsenal. And that means the people who I write about are ordinary servicemen and women whose job it is to maintain the weapons, repair the weapons, the designers who created them, the pilots who fly the planes that would carry them, the missile crews responsible for launching them, and in one case, a bomb squad technician who was trained in case of a nuclear accident to go over to a nuclear weapon that had been damaged and try to defuse it by hand. So the book is full of the courage and the patriotism of ordinary servicemen in the Cold War. I think it's a subject that's been greatly neglected. So it's not just a critique of our government or a simplistic anti-war screed. It really looks at the challenges of how do you manage this highly complex, highly dangerous technology. The title of the book is Command and Control, and the overall subject of the book is the effort, really since the beginning of the atomic era in the Second World War to the present day, of the United States to control its own weapons. We hear a lot about Pakistani weapons, the threat of an Iranian bomb, but I'm talking about American weapons and the struggle to control them. And by control them, I mean to make sure they don't detonate by accident, to make sure they can't be sabotaged or stolen or used by someone within our own military without proper authorization. And it's remarkable how difficult it's been to guarantee all of those things. One of the underlying themes of the book is the extraordinary difficulty of controlling complex technologies. The subtitle of the book includes the phrase, the illusion of safety. I could also have put it, the illusion of control. These things are so complicated that they were constantly on the verge of being out of our control. If you think of a nuclear weapon as a machine, a man-made machine, well, every machine that we've ever invented has failed at one point or another. Think about your toaster oven. Think about your laptop that suddenly freezes. Cars overheat. Commercial airliners, incredible, brilliant, ingenious inventions, occasionally crash because of a design fault or a maintenance problem or a lightning storm. We have nuclear power plants, incredibly ingenious, complex technological systems that every now and then melt down. Well, these nuclear weapons are machines too, but they're the most dangerous machines ever invented. And it's a tragedy. It's a horrible tragedy if an airliner crashes and 200 or 300 or 400 people even are killed. But the consequences of a nuclear weapon failing and detonating accidentally or inadvertently would kill thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. So it's an important subject, and you know, given my nature or my personality, the fact that the government really did not want people to have access to this information made me feel like I really needed to find the information and provide it to people. So why did I write this book, and how did I go from hamburgers and French fries to atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs? Fast Food Nation was set in the city of Colorado Springs, and it just so happens that Colorado Springs has some very important Air Force installations. In Fast Food Nation, I opened the book by visiting this important command center inside of a mountain, Cheyenne Mountain. It's incredible. It's like out of a movie. You go through this long tunnel, you're inside the mountain, and that's where the headquarters of our NORAD early warning system is. And there are other bases in Colorado Springs, the U.S. Air Force Space Command and the U.S. Space Command. So I wound up, after I wrote Fast Food Nation, spending time with Air Force officers because I was very curious about these bases. And they started telling me stories. A lot of them had been launch officers, missile officers, underground, ready to fire intercontinental ballistic missiles at the Soviet Union. And one of them told me a story about an accident in Damascus, Arkansas. And the details of the accident were just extraordinary to me. I couldn't get it out of my head. And so I tracked down one of the people who played a central role in trying to deal with the accident, and I went and visited him, and he just opened up, and we spent 2 days talking about what had happened in Arkansas, and I knew I had to write this as a book. So, what happened in Arkansas? Well, I'm not going to tell you the whole story, because it's, firstly, the book is pretty long, and I don't want to keep you too long, but also, I don't want to give away what happens. But here's the outline of it. In this missile silo in Arkansas, in the foothills of the Ozarks, with bucolic rolling hills nearby and little farmhouses nearby, there was a repairman doing some routine maintenance on a ballistic missile. It was an unusual missile, the Titan II. It was the biggest intercontinental ballistic missile the United States has ever built. And on top of it was the most powerful thermonuclear warhead the United States has ever put on top of a missile. That one warhead had more destructive power by three. It had three times the destructive power of all the bombs used by all the militaries in the Second World War combined, including both atomic bombs. Hugely powerful warhead. So this repairman is doing some routine maintenance, and he's screwing a pressure cap, kind of thing you do all the time on the missile. He's near the top of the missile, and the socket falls off of the wrench handle he's using. And the socket falls onto the steel work platform he's on, and it bounces, and he literally grabs for it and just misses it. And through some freak one-in-a-million occurrence, the socket goes through the very narrow gap between the steel platform and the missile. And it falls about 70 feet down this missile silo, ricochets off part of the silo, and hits the missile and pierces the skin, the metal skin of the missile. And the workman is literally seeing this happen, and in the next moment, he sees rocket fuel start pouring out of the missile like water being sprayed by a garden hose. And this rocket fuel is incredibly toxic and lethal. So toxic and lethal that workmen like him, when they go into the silo, have to wear basically spacesuits. They look like spacesuits with a bubble helmet and full covering and an air pack on the back. but this fuel is also highly explosive and can be easily detonated by the smallest spark. And suddenly the Air Force is confronted with the fact that the missile silo is filling with thousands and thousands of gallons of explosive fuel with the most powerful nuclear warhead we've ever put on a missile, and they don't know what to do because nothing like this has ever happened before. And the book tells the story of the efforts by a handful of really brave young men. One of the things that stunned me, and maybe it's a sign of how old I'm getting, is the people who are handling our nuclear weapons, the most destructive weapons ever invented, are 19, 20, 21 years old. The bomb squad technician I mentioned earlier, whose job it was to walk over to a damaged nuclear weapon and try to defuse it so it wouldn't detonate, 20 years old. So this is the story of a group of 20, 22, 23-year-old guys who were sent back into this complex to try to save the missile and try to prevent it from exploding with this warhead on top, and nobody's had to try to do what they're ordered to do before. And to me, it's an extraordinary story, not just because the details are mind-blowing, but because implicit in this story are so many of the central themes of my book, which are about the fact that human beings are fallible. And it's too much to expect of us to create systems or machines that are infallible. We're much better at creating complex technologies than we are at controlling them. Now, the book was originally going to be about that long, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And it was going to be that long because I was just going to tell this incredible story of this accident at a missile site. And by the way, Bill Clinton was the governor of the state at the time, and he wasn't that far away. And Chelsea Clinton was 1 year old. And Vice President Mondale happened to be visiting Arkansas that day. And if this nuclear warhead had detonated, it would have engulfed the state of Arkansas in firestorms. And it would have destroyed the state. And it would have sent lethal radioactive fallout all the way up the East Coast. So this could have changed the course of our history. But as I was researching it, I found another story. If you look at the newspaper accounts of this accident back from 1980, and it just so happens this week, and this was not a marketing ploy, this week is the 33rd anniversary of this weapons accident. The Air Force, the Pentagon said, there was no way that warhead could have detonated. These warheads are perfectly safe. But then I met with a weapons designer who worked on many of these warheads, who told me about the safety problems that were present with our warheads starting in the 1950s, really through the end of the 1980s. And despite the denials from the Pentagon, we had many weapons that could detonate through accidents, through an explosion, through a fire, through lightning, in some cases just by being dropped, not from a very high height, I mean from a height like of this ceiling there. And so it led to a whole other narrative that's also in the book, which is by a group of weapons designers at the Sandia National Laboratory who first realize that our weapons have some basic safety problems, and second, have to fight a bureaucratic battle to convince the Pentagon and convince the military that there is this severe safety problem and that one of these warheads could go off by accident. And I was able to obtain, it took a long time, I was able to obtain documents through the Freedom of Information Act that completely confirmed their assertions. The warhead on that Titan II missile in Arkansas was in some ways an unsafe warhead, and we would never allow a warhead like that to be used in our arsenal today, because now we have a greater understanding of the safety problems with nuclear warheads. So the book looks at this one accident. It looks at the effort to maintain and create nuclear weapon safety, and it also looks at the efforts to just control our weapons through other means. And the more I learned about this subject, and when I was at college, I actually studied nuclear strategy, and I studied from someone who had been involved in the Pentagon. I was very interested in nuclear weapons during the Cold War because it seemed like such an extraordinary threat. So I think compared to most people, I think I knew a lot about nuclear weapons, but it wasn't until I started interviewing former bomber pilots, former launch officers, technicians who were nuclear weapon repairmen, weapons designers, some former Pentagon officials and secretaries of defense. I realized during the research of this book that my ignorance on the subject was profound and that the American people had not been allowed to know all kinds of crucial information about our nuclear weapon management and our nuclear war strategies that people really need to know. So that's why I wrote the book. And what did I find? I've told you a little bit about what I found, but one other anecdote I'll tell you is that from the very beginning, from the invention of this technology, it's been a real struggle to control it. The very first test of a nuclear device occurred in July of 1945, and people didn't even know if it was going to work. And there was concern among some of the physicists at Los Alamos in New Mexico that if you detonated a nuclear device, it would ignite the atmosphere and destroy the world. Now, there were computations done that suggested that wasn't going to happen, but we would not know for sure until the first one detonated. So at the Trinity site in July of 1945, they put this huge nuclear device that looks like a mad scientist's invention, this gigantic metallic orb with all these wires coming out of it. It looks like something you would make to help create Frankenstein's monster. They put it at the top of this 100-foot steel tower with a little steel shed over it to protect it. And the night before they were going to detonate it, Oppenheimer and some of the other scientists got worried that someone might try to sabotage the test. Because here was this nuclear device that had cost so much money to invent just sitting there in the desert by itself. So there was a young scientist, Daniel Hornig, who was instructed to climb up the ladder to the top of the steel tower and babysit the bomb until it was time to detonate it. It began to rain very heavily, and some severe electrical storms entered the area. And one of Hornig's responsibilities, he was only 25 years old, but he had designed one of the most important components of this nuclear device. It was called the X unit, and the X unit stored all this electricity, and then at the right moment, dumped the electricity into the detonators would go off, and the nuclear device would explode. It was an ingenious invention, and the only problem was it was vulnerable to going off and being triggered by static electricity in the air. And Hornig knew that because the previous week, one of the X units had triggered during a lightning storm. It hadn't been connected to a nuclear device, but he knew better than anyone else that this nuclear device he was sitting right next to by himself in the middle of the night atop a steel tower with a steel roof could be detonated not just by a direct lightning strike, but by a nearby lightning strike. And he sat there by himself listening to the thunder and counting 1-1,000, 2-1,000, 3-1,000, trying to calculate the distance of the lightning. As it poured and as the wind blew, he sat there alone with one light bulb above his head for 3 hours. And at midnight, he got the signal to come down. And he was very relieved to come down. So had lightning struck and triggered the X unit, that device probably would have detonated full scale and would have proved that a nuclear weapon was possible, but it also would have claimed its first victim. And ever since that night, there has been a struggle to control this technology and make sure that it doesn't go off by accident. One of the other things that I learned that was extraordinary for me is just how powerful these weapons are. We have forgotten it. The last detonation of a nuclear weapon, American nuclear weapon, in the atmosphere, outdoors, was in 1962. So, you know, the last person in the United States who's seen one of these nuclear tests is probably in his or her early 70s. And to demonstrate to you the power of these weapons, I'll give you a sense of two of them. The first nuclear weapon ever used was dropped over the city of Hiroshima. It was an early design. It was an extremely inefficient, crude design. It used 144 pounds of uranium, 235, this fissile material in which a chain reaction could happen very quickly and create a nuclear explosion. When the bomb detonated, it was so inefficient that 139 pounds of the 144 pounds never even underwent a nuclear reaction. About 139 pounds of that uranium just got blown up like a conventional explosive had blown it up. It just went flying out into the air. Only 5 pounds of the 144 actually fissioned. And of that 5 pounds, most of it in the nuclear process didn't get turned into energy, didn't get turned into explosive energy. Most of that 5 pounds turned into other radioactive elements. The amount of pure energy created by the Hiroshima bomb came from 0.6 grams of uranium-235. 0.6 grams. Let me see what I've got here. Okay. This weighs more than 0.6 grams. When 0.6 grams of uranium was turned into pure energy above Hiroshima, 80,000 people were killed. And 2/3 of the buildings in a huge city were destroyed by 0.6 grams of uranium. And within years, within less than a decade of that bomb's detonation, the United States had an arsenal with weapons vastly, vastly more powerful. And enormous science experiments were being done by our nuclear physicists and bomb designers. The first test of a hydrogen bomb that might actually be usable in warfare was done, I think, in 1954. And the nickname for the weapon was Shrimp, ironically. And this was a nuclear test that went completely out of control. Once the weapon detonated, the fireball got bigger and bigger, and the scientists who were observing it got more and more afraid because the bomb and the weapon and its detonation was so much bigger than it was expected to be. Their calculations were wrong. It wound up to have an explosive force 3 times larger than was predicted. 20 miles away from the point of detonation, American observers were in a concrete bunker 20 miles away, and the bunker began to move as though a severe earthquake was occurring. And when they opened up the door to the bunker on this remote Pacific island, the trees had been knocked down. And the radiation levels, they quickly realized, were so dangerous that the scientists were trapped inside this bunker. the fireball created by this blast was about 4 miles wide. And later studies showed that the amount of earth that it displaced and sucked up into the air, into the mushroom cloud, because a mushroom cloud is largely composed of the ground matter and debris that's just pulled up way into the air. Well, 200 billion pounds of debris were pulled up into the air. And if you want to visualize that, think of an area of land the size of a football field, and if you put 200 billion pounds of debris on it, that pile would extend about 7 miles into the sky. Weapons of unbelievable destructiveness. And within about 10 years of that test of shrimp, the United States had 32,000 nuclear weapons. And the Soviet Union, within a few years of that, had 35,000 nuclear weapons. Most of these weapons vastly more powerful than the one that destroyed Hiroshima. And in the book, I look at the challenge of just managing inventory on that scale. It took extraordinary technological and administrative skill. If we had one of our weapons detonate by accident out of 32,000, it would have meant that we took good care of 31,999, which is an incredible success rate. But when you're talking about this technology, anything less than perfect success is unacceptable. Again and again and again, the people I interviewed for this book, from former secretaries of defense to warhead repairmen, said to me, it's miraculous that none of these weapons detonated during the Cold War. None of the Soviet weapons, none of the American weapons. It's amazing that a major city has not been destroyed by a nuclear weapon since Nagasaki in 1945. But there's no guarantee that our good fortune will last. How is any of this relevant today? And is this just interesting historical detail? Well, right now as I speak, there are thousands of nuclear weapons, probably at least 2,000 on alert right now, ready to be used at a moment's notice. And the consciousness of our nuclear arsenal and of the world's nuclear arsenal has sort of vanished, but the danger never went away. And I would love to tell you that the problems I write in the book have all been solved. This summer, two of our three Minuteman missile wings were cited for safety violations. A few years ago, the Air Force's largest storage facility for nuclear weapons had its entire management team decertified, essentially fired, for safety violations. And there's a new threat, which sounds like something out of a Hollywood thriller. In 2010, 50 of our intercontinental ballistic missiles at F.E. Warren Air Force Base went offline, which means that their launch control centers could no longer communicate to the missiles. And this problem lasted for an hour. It was eventually traced back to a single computer chip that had been improperly installed in a processor. And the Air Force denied at the time there was any possibility that someone had hacked into our nuclear command and control system. This year, the Defense Science Board issued a report saying that the vulnerability of our nuclear command and control system to being hacked has never been fully assessed. And this spring, the head of the U.S. Strategic Command, responsible for all of our nuclear weapons, testified before the Senate that he felt confident that hackers couldn't get into our nuclear command and control system, but, quote, we don't know what we don't know. And when he was asked at this hearing, could a hacker hack into the Russian or the Chinese command and control systems and launch one of their missiles, his response was, quote, "Senator, I don't know." So this isn't a problem that was solved. And having taken you through all these grim facts, I, having spent 6 years full-time researching and writing this book, I am not overwhelmed by apocalyptic thoughts, and I don't think that we're inevitably doomed. It's amazing that the Soviet Union vanished from the face of the earth without a Third World War. When I was growing up, if you said to people, the Berlin Wall will come down, Germany will be reunited, people will be dancing in the streets, the Soviet Union will vanish without anyone being killed, people would have thought that you had been smoking way too much weed. And all these things happened, but they just didn't happen. It was people who made change happen in the right way. It's been forgotten that one of the most effective political movements in our history was the nuclear freeze movement. Ronald Reagan took office as belligerent a cold warrior as there's ever been, and he left office committed to abolishing nuclear weapons. I think his change of heart was sincere, but I think it was also influenced by the fact that the biggest political demonstration in American history occurred in Central Park. Almost a million, some people say, 750,000 to 1 million people demonstrated against this nuclear arms race. And there were 2 million people who marched throughout Western Europe, and constant demonstrations. And so I don't think any of these problems are inevitable. But the first step towards making the change towards a safer world and a more rational world is to become aware of what the problem is. And that's really why I wrote this book. I'm not trying to preach any one point of view to anyone. I think there are all kinds of valid arguments for abolishing nuclear weapons entirely, for having 1,000 of them, for having 300 of them. But the decisions need to be made by the American people and not by a small group of policymakers in Washington, D.C., who are acting largely in secret. So this is my effort to lift the veil on this secrecy and to introduce some democracy into the management of the most dangerous things we've ever built. So, that's my talk. I'm curious if any of you have any questions. Yeah.
Excuse me, wait for the mic.
Yes, thank you. I read a couple of reviews of your book in the last week or two. I believe the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal both had reviews. And one of the reviewers was very complimentary of you personally and of your integrity on this. But he's pointed out that, with all that, there has never been an accident which released any radioactive material in the U.S. And there are also nuclear weapons in Russia, in Pakistan, in India, in China, and et cetera, in Israel. I don't know if they have ever had a nuclear accident produced. So this is a remarkable, as you said, it's an amazing, but it suggests that the safety mechanisms worked, that the safety mechanisms were good. And in addition, would you agree that that with each accident, with each event, they've been improved, and the safety today is much better than it was some years ago?
I hate to disillusion you. You can't believe everything you read in the Wall Street Journal. And the Wall Street Journal has been extremely critical of everything I've written. And in the case of the review that you just mentioned, it's factually incorrect. We have had numerous accidents with nuclear weapons that have released plutonium into the environment. You can look up on Wikipedia two of them very easily, and then others I write about in the book are more difficult to find. Over Palomares, Spain, a B-52 bomber collided with its tankers, and its four hydrogen bombs were dropped over Spain and contaminated the little town of Palomares with plutonium, and the plutonium is still in the soil there. One of our most important military installations, the early warning radar system in Thule, Greenland, was almost destroyed by another B-52 bomber that caught on fire because one of the crew members had stowed rubber seat cushions under his seat near a heat vent. This is how accidents happen. The rubber seat cushions caught on fire. The cockpit filled with smoke. The pilot was just able to move the bomber out of the way of the base before he bailed out. And enormous amounts of plutonium were spread throughout the Arctic. And I think it was 137 rail cars of contaminated ice and water were later brought back to the United States. In the United States, there was a nuclear weapon accident in Johnson Township, New Jersey, actually not that far from where we are right now, in which there was a fire with a nuclear weapon. The plutonium melted. The fire was put out. The weapon didn't detonate. But the plutonium, because firefighters had sprayed it with water, the plutonium left the missile complex, went into a storm drain, and contaminated the area around it. I mean, I can go through a list again and again. I have no problem when people disagree with me vehemently. You should hear what happens to me at home. But I'm telling you, that review was irresponsibly, factually incorrect. The heart of this book is about the brave effort by our scientists to make our weapons safer. One of the heroes of this book is someone named Robert Purifoy, an engineer at the Sandia National Laboratory. Every nuclear weapon we have today has the safety mechanisms that he helped invent and introduce. There's no question that our nuclear weapons are safer today than they were 30 years ago. I write about that extensively in the book. What's still a problem is the bombs may be safer and the warheads may be safer, but the weapon systems as a whole are still very complex. The B-52 bombers that are the bulk of our nuclear bombing fleet, the last one was built in 1962. The Minuteman missiles, which are basically our land-based missiles, haven't been built since the early 1970s. So anyway, this is a long answer, but that was a factually inaccurate and I thought irresponsible review. And I don't mind it when people greatly dislike my work or even tell me what page they quit reading out of boredom, but that was factually inaccurate. Anyway. Yeah.
I haven't read the book yet, so I don't know if you've addressed this in the book, but have you gotten a sense through your research in nuclear technology of how we compare to other countries with their safety mechanisms, other accidents around? Have you gotten, even indirectly or through anecdote, any sense that we should be even more worried about other countries, or do they have things that we can learn from? Did you get any sense of that?
Yeah. There's good news and there's bad news. The good news is I genuinely believe that we have the safest system that there is. We invented this technology. We have, you know, huge experience with it dating back to 1945. And I believe that our administrative and technological systems are the best. And yet this book is full of near misses and close calls, given that we're the best. Somebody someday should write a book about what was happening in the Soviet Union. The amount of radioactivity and the amount of harm and the explosions that they had at their nuclear processing facilities and the amount of contamination in the former Soviet Union from the way that they were processing uranium and plutonium is just unbelievable. So there is little doubt in my mind there were all kinds of weapons accidents there. I just don't speak Russian and had no way to research that. When Iraq had a nuclear weapons program, as they did before the first Gulf War, when the UN inspectors went and looked at some of their weapons designs, and I quoted in the book, one of the inspectors was quoted as saying about one of the Iraqi warheads, if it had been built, it would have detonated if it fell off of a table. It was a highly unstable design. At the end of the book, I look at other countries and their rate of industrial accidents as a rough measure of how competent they might be with complex technological systems like nuclear weapons. And I would prefer Pakistan, North Korea, India, not to have nuclear weapons. And I would prefer Russia to have as few as humanly possible. They had a major fire recently on one of their nuclear submarines, and the fire was going on while the, you know, they denied. There's always this initial denial, perfectly safe, not a problem, and it only turns out later that the truth emerges. Initially, Russia denied there were any nuclear weapons or missiles on the submarine when the fire was burning out of control. And it turns out that wasn't true. So, you know, the more of these weapons there are in the world and the more countries that have them, the more likely there is to be a major city destroyed by one of them, either deliberately or accidentally. And critical as I am of our management, I'll take our management of this technology over anyone else's. Yeah, back there.
During the course of your work, did you get an idea as to how likely or unlikely it is that terrorists could get their hands on a smaller nuclear device and detonate it at a target of their choice?
In 2007, we lost control of half a dozen of our thermonuclear warheads for a day and a half. It was a snafu at Minot Air Force Base, where these cruise missiles with nuclear warheads were inadvertently removed from a bunker. The people removing them didn't realize they had nuclear warheads on it. No one asked them to sign for these weapons with warheads on it. They were loaded onto an airplane. No one loading them onto the plane knew the nuclear warheads were there. The people flying the plane didn't realize they were flying a plane with nuclear warheads. The plane parked on a runway for 9 hours unattended. For a full day and a half, the Air Force didn't realize that six thermonuclear weapons were missing. This was a real wake-up call, because saboteurs, insiders, terrorists could have taken those nuclear weapons, and we might not have even realized it. The Secretary of Defense at the time, Robert Gates, did the appropriate thing and fired the leadership of the Air Force. This was unbelievable that this happened. So it's possible, and now I think you do have to sign for nuclear warheads before you remove them from a bunker. And I'm not kidding you, at the time there were no barcodes or anything like that on the nuclear weapons. There were just serial numbers that you wrote down by hand when you took one out of a bunker. Now I think there are the kind of barcodes that FedEx has used for like the last 20 years, and supermarkets use. So there is the chance of the theft of a weapon. The most likely place that would occur would be Pakistan. The most disturbing thing that's come out of Snowden's revelations through the NSA documents that he stole isn't that we're all being spied on, because as a paranoid investigative journalist, I just assume that's true. For me, what was most disturbing were the documents he found that suggested the American intelligence community really doesn't know anything about how Pakistan is storing, managing, controlling, moving its weapons. That's the most likely place for it to happen. But even more concerning, if terrorists really want to make a nuclear weapon, use a nuclear weapon, they don't have to steal one. The biggest danger is from the huge amounts of uranium-235 and plutonium that the former Soviet Union still, you know, manufactured and still has tons and tons of this stuff. And if any of that is stolen, you know, you don't need a lot of it, as the story I told earlier on about how little you need to destroy a city, and that would be a greater concern. I hate to bum you all out, but this is reality, and it's better not to be in denial.
Yeah, I wanted to ask the question. Do you get a sense that people in our government and people, you know, in the international community that we're aligned with are as concerned about this as you evidently are?
I think a lot of people in our government would not be aware of a lot of the accidents I write about in this book because there was such secrecy around them. But I feel very confident that our president is deeply concerned about nuclear weapons and very much wants to reduce the number of them throughout the world in the hope of eventually abolishing them. And what upsets me more than the leadership of our government is the lack of awareness in the general public. And the speech that he gave, you know, didn't even resonate in some ways with the audience in Prague in 2009 because half of the American people were either not born or were small children when the Soviet Union vanished. And the audience that he spoke to in Prague was very young, and there's just this sort of historical amnesia about this problem. But again, you know, I am not overwhelmed with depression by these problems, and I would not have spent 6 years on this book if I thought it was totally futile to try to do anything. At the very top of our government, we have someone, I think, who is sincerely concerned and trying to do something about it. Yeah.
I wanted to ask about some of the people who opened up to you for the book.
Yeah.
You described not, although you may have sources at the top level, you focused on many of the people who were at getting really working on maintenance of the weapons and that close quarters. Were any of the people you spoke to responsible for any of the accidents or directly involved in any of the things that happened that led to any of the snafus you're talking about? And for the younger ones, or the ones who were young when they were dealing with this stuff, did anybody express a sense that they had been young and naive, and, you know, did they express anything along those lines?
Yeah. Okay. I interviewed a lot of high-level people as well. I just didn't write about them. And I focused on the younger ordinary servicemen. I interviewed the young man who dropped the socket and who was held responsible for the accident, when in reality it was an aging, obsolete weapon system that shouldn't have been in service anymore. The problems lay deeply within the system. Some crucial decisions that were the wrong decisions as the accident unfolded were made by the hires up. And, you know, when it came time to punish some people, they punished the people at the bottom. I interviewed people who were injured in nuclear weapons accidents and who lost friends in nuclear weapons accidents. And, you know, again, to me, the most important part are the ordinary servicemen and women who risked their lives, who really sacrificed a great deal. When you had one of these high security clearances, you couldn't talk to your spouse or your family about what you were doing. And being in command or being in control of nuclear weapons was an incredibly stressful job because these people knew better than anyone the destructive force of the weapons that they were handling. And I love the film Dr. Strangelove, which is brilliant. But I interviewed hundreds of people, and I never met one who was a warmongering, right-wing fanatic, eager to nuke the Soviets. They were well aware of the consequence of these weapons being used. And I'll just wrap that this answer up by saying, what's amazing is I talk about this nuclear freeze movement and the biggest political demonstration in American history. If you were to go to that demonstration, most of the people would be in their 20s, mid-20s. It was led by young people. The most anti-nuclear weapon people in the United States are 75, 85, in their early 90s. They understand these systems. Henry Kissinger, not generally known as a peacenik, George Shultz, William Perry, Sam Nunn, these are high-level people who dealt with nuclear weapons, who think they should be abolished. And again, I met with people who had been bomber pilots, people who had been launch officers, who were deeply concerned about nuclear weapons, while among people who are in their 20s, there is a profound lack of awareness. Okay, yeah.
Given the documentation and effort you put into finding all and listing all of these accidents, many of them in the United States and then elsewhere too, to the extent that you're able to find information, why isn't it that a major city anywhere in the world hasn't suffered the consequence with a major attack, a nuclear explosion? Why?
I've done one other reading for this book this week. This is only the second time I've talked to people about the book. And someone came over to me after that reading and gave me his explanation. And it was the intervention of UFOs. It was UFOs who were looking after Earth, and when these accidents were occurring, were making sure that none of the weapons detonated. Now, I have no evidence to argue with him, and I didn't want to argue him out of his belief system. It's amazing. If you just look at how close we came, don't even think about accidents, but how close we came on a number of occasions to actually launching our missiles deliberately at the Soviet Union. And yet, as I said, the Cold War ended without a war. It's amazing. And I guess all I can say is good things happen sometimes. But we can't assume that's always going to be the case. The Chernobyl nuclear power plant operated flawlessly and perfectly for thousands and thousands of hours. And then it didn't. And the problems with that plant became apparent once it was, you know, going out of control and melting down. So, I quote a very famous economist, Oscar Morgenstern, who was, you know, one of the co-inventors of game theory, who talked about it in terms of probability. You know, the more weapons you have, the longer you have them, human beings made them, one day one of them's going to detonate. And we're just really fortunate it hasn't happened yet. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.